Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
Which brings us to the topic for today, which is, do you have something to add to us? Which is Venus and Adonis in Book 3, overarching the entire Book 3. And I wanted to start by, you know, we're going to go through a number of passages rapidly. And I wanted to start by mentioning the first allusion I can think of to the Venus-Adonis story in Book 3. Let me just ask what, you know, obviously the Castle Joyous Tapestry is the first sustained explicit reference to Venus and Adonis in Book 3. To my mind, that's the second kind of allusion. The first one is something that you wouldn't pick up on except on a second reading when you're looking for Venus and Adonis motifs. What, anybody by any chance have a thought or a guess? Yes, Seth?
Possibly when Geong is not by his horse.
That's interesting. That's possible. He doesn't really get gore, you know, but, you know, that's a decent speculation. I was thinking of the fact that the forester that runs by prior to that is described as carrying not just a spear, a boar spear. So, you know, you're not expected to pick up on that. Spencer did expect you to pick up on that first time. But you certainly, a modern reader, would not until second or third reading. But once you've discovered that Venus and Adonis are throughout this book, you notice those things and you start asking yourself, why? Why Venus and Adonis? So, the tapestry in Castle Joyous, second reference, third that we've identified already, in fact, is at the end of Canto 1, Britomart being wounded by the arrow. So, you know, three inside Canto 1. In one of the cantos we didn't read, Britomart wounds Marinel, a knight, in a way that reminds you of Adonis being wounded. But when you get to the Garden of Adonis, or when you get to Canto 6, and let's turn there now, obviously this is all about the Venus and Adonis story. Canto 6 starts out by telling us how Belphoebe was born. It's a very interesting story. It's quite amusing. Can anyone recount for us how Belphoebe is born? Yep.
Wasn't her mom lying in a field and was impregnated by the rays of the sun?
Indeed.
And then it was actually twins?
Yes.
And then Diana and Cupid, right?
Uh-huh. No, Diana.
And Venus, yeah, okay.
Venus
came
was
by
hunting
when they were
for, Cupid.
For Cupid.
Cupid, right.
And then they said, oh, I'll take one twin, you take one twin. And then Diana took her and then raised her.
Impressive. What have you been memorizing?
What?
Spencer. Very
Spencer.
Nice. Very nice. I thought we ought to look at the imagery of Chrysogony in Canto 6, Stanza 5, which is very much an image. Let's start on Stanza 6. Matt's already told us what happens. But wondrously they were begot and bred through influence of the heaven's fruitful ray. As it in antique books is mentioned, it was upon a summer's shiny day when Titan fair his beams did display. Titan, which Titan would that be? They say Helios. Canto 6, Stanza 6.
Okay.
Helios, the Titan of the sun. What's the sun's name? What's the Greek god of the sun that displaces?
Apollo.
Last name? Apollo. It's pretty important. What? Apollo Creed. That's
13.
What?
13.
Phoebus.
Oh.
Or sometimes Phoebus Apollo.
Nice.
What? Yes. His beams did display in a fresh fountain far from all men's view. She bathed her breasts, the boiling heat to allay. She bathed with roses red and violets blue, and all the sweetest flowers that in the forest grew, till faint through irksome weariness, down upon the grassy ground herself she laid to sleep, the whiles a gentle slumbering swoon upon her fell, all naked, bare displayed. The sunbeams bright upon her body played, being through former bathing mollified, and pierced into her womb, where they embayed with so sweet sense and secret power of unspied, that in her pregnant flesh they shortly fructified. Miraculous may seem to him that reads so strange an sample of conception. Yes. But reason teacheth that the fruitful seeds of all things living, through impression of the sunbeams in moist complexion, do life conceive and quickened are by kind. So after Nihilus inundation, infinite shapes of creatures men do find, informed in the mud on which the sun hath shined. Let's discuss that passage. I want to hear your all views from you about why that little tale, which is entirely invented by Spencer. Belphoebe and Amoret are his characters, his inventions. Their mother, his invention. So he made all this up. He put it in the poem. He put it in Canto 6 before you get to the Garden of Adonis. So talk to me for a minute about why he did that. What's being alluded to? What's going on? Yes.
He probably wanted to give the characters a sort of like supernatural aspect to them to get them above.
Absolutely. They're not goddesses, but they are somehow on this plane. Remember when we were talking about Northrop Frye's various levels, and we said that the Garden of Eden and the Garden of Adonis were part of our world, but as it best could be or could become. You know, it's a mortal world, but it's an ideal mortal world. So yes, he wanted to elevate them beyond common maidens. What else? Why else would he begin Canto 6 with them? That?
Well, Canto 6 also has, I think it's full of biblical allegory. And I think this is sort of a biblical allegory too.
How is this a biblical allegory?
It's
like an Immaculate Conception. It is the virgin birth.
And
yes. Also, I can't remember, I'm not sure, but who are supposed to be Achilles' parents? Is it
Zeus and someone?
And I remember a story about like in the Iliad where Zeus came down in swan form.
That would be Leda and the Swan, and if you keep your finger in the canto, if you go to Canto 11, in the tapestry, which is a tapestry of Cupid, and what is chapter 12 devoted to? Canto 12 devoted to, just quickly.
The procession.
What's that procession of? It's called the Mask of Cupid. Both 11 and 12 are entirely about Bucerain's castle is entirely devoted to Cupid. And so, so that's one reason I thought that it would be pretty clear one word answer that the tapestry was about Cupid. Those of you that said the lusts of the gods, that's probably going to be an acceptable answer because it's certainly devoted to that as well. So go to Canto 11, stanza 32. The tapestry begins on stanza 29, and goes down and gives us, just for some of the high points, Europa, Jove taking taking Europa. How does he come to Europa?
As a
white bull, and takes her, and she's so charmed by the beauty of the white bull, she climbs on the back of the bull, and he swims across the Mediterranean and has his way with her on the other side of that pond. And down in stanza 32, then was he turned into a snowy swan to win fair Leda to his lovely trade. O wondrous skill and sweet wit of the man that in her daffodillies sleeping made, from scorching heat her dainty limbs to shade, while the proud bird, ruffing his feathers wide and brushing his fair breast, did her invade. Jove was not a chaste man, particularly when under the influence of Cupid. In between 30 and 31, Jove's adventure with Danae is recounted. Do you remember the story of Danae? No? What? He impregnates everybody. Yes, he impregnates her. How? With a shower of gold. Is that a story you've heard of before? Her Danae's father wants to protect her virginity, imprisons her in a tower room, and he sneaks in through the window as a shower of gold. Soon after that, into a golden shower himself he changed fair Danae to view, and through the roof of her strong brazen tower did rain into her lap and honey dew, the whiles her foolish guard that little knew of such deceit kept that iron door fast barred and watched that none should enter nor issue. Vain was the watch and bootless all the ward, whenas the god to golden hue himself transferred. Clever guy. I've brought you a picture of Danae by Titian.
Seven and eight?
I'm going to go to seven and eight. I just wanted to... excuse me. This is one of Titian depicted this more than once. This is one of his most famous ones. It's the best reproduction I could come up with. You can see the shower is sunlight. You see he's got the clouds there. Coming out of the clouds are beams of sun, and the sun is changing into coins, which a greedy attendant is trying to collect as they come. Any comments you'd like to make on that? Any interpretive comments?
Story or opinion? I didn't expect it to be so
either
dark.
One. What?
I didn't expect it.
It's just a poor reproduction. When you see it in person, it's very dramatic. Really dramatic. I've seen three of Titian's depictions of Danae in the shower of gold in person. In Vienna, I don't want to say this on the record. I think in Vienna, and I think in Munich, and maybe once in Florence at the... But at any rate, any comments?
Is that a dog?
It's a lap dog.
It's a lap dog?
I wasn't even sure.
You know, Venus is often seen with a small animal, lap dog. Why? What? The same reason what?
Paris Hilton has a dog.
I was
going to
say that.
It may be. Any other way you'd want to read that image? But, you know, it's a sexual image, a displacement of female sexuality. And what about the way the attendant is collecting the gold with her cloak? You can see that it said rained into her lap. So again, what Titian's done is displace the beams of gold from one lady's lap to the other, to there. In another one, the most famous one of all, it's much more directly on target and much more erotic, and I don't understand why I was unable rapidly to find a reproduction of the most erotic of his depictions. But at any rate, you get the imagery there, I think. And here is another version, and again, you have a kind of a cup and chalice is often an image of female sexuality. Again, you can see the gold. I wanted you there to see this one so that you could see the gold coins a little more distinctly there. Now, flipping back from Venus and Adonis, excuse me, from Danae in Canto 11 to Canto 6. Talk about Canto 6 more. You've said you've said it's a virgin birth.
Twins.
Pardon me?
Twins.
Well, birth while she was asleep as well.
Pardon me? Pardon me?
She had a painless birth while she was asleep.
Oh, she does have a painless birth. I mean, that's pretty comic line. It stands at 27.
Yeah,
unawares she them conceived, unwares she bore without in pain that she conceived without in pleasure. So while she slept, she was impregnated, she conceived. While she slept, she gave birth.
Then they just up and snatched.
Pardon me? What's the connection between this painting and Belphoebe's conception? Why was I skipping from those back and forth between those two passages?
Because
she's not sleeping.
Yeah,
that's true. That's a difference.
It's the light.
There's no nail.
It's the light.
Yeah.
Talk to us.
Well, it was a golden. It was a sunbeam. For Belphoebe.
Yeah.
And but in this one, it's a golden shower.
Well, but it's but notice
but it's
all
still,
the
in
depictions.
The painting, it's still a sunbeam.
Exactly, the golden shower was almost always interpreted by artists as sunbeams, so that this conception in Spencer is playing, I think, on the conception by Danae by a beam of light. What about the virgin birth? How is that discussed and depicted in the Bible or in painting? Pardon me?
I'm Jewish, but I'm not sure about this, but is Virgin Mary the birth to Jesus?
The virgin birth is that he has his hand up. Yes.
I forget which one. There is a very famous maista, which is like a centerpiece in an altar, that has Jesus as a ray of light, a golden ray of light, beaming down towards the Virgin Mary's stomach.
Bingo. Fra Angelico's The Annunciation, circa 1432, is one of literally hundreds of depictions of the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Birth with the descent of the Spirit to impregnate Mary as a beam of light turning into a dove. So where the beam of light in Titian turned into gold, in a lot of Christian iconography, the beam of light from the sun turns into the dove, the spirit, and the Trinity. Yes, Wesley.
Oh, I just think it's notable to mark how in Christianity it was important to have a virgin birth because it was through man that sin was carried. And that wasn't that sex was sinful. It was that it was it was the fallibility of man that was the original sin, and it was inherent within man. And I think that was what he was also alluding to in Dairy Queen, because she had her birth through chastity. She was chaste, but and that was how it was. They were both pure.
There are two astute elements to that comment. One is that it's the fall of man and woman that brought sin into the world, not sex itself. Consequently, note what Fra Angelico has depicted in the left side of the panel. What is it? What? No, it's not the Garden of Adonis. Spencer invented that.
Is that Cupid?
No.
I think that's an apple tree.
It's an apple tree. It's the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. It's the expulsion of so that Fra Angelico, like Wesley, wanted to connect these two motifs. There on the left, the introduction of sin to the world. There on the right, the restoration of the possibility of sinless conception. So that it was, as I said, it was not sex that was the problem. It was sin. And how is that relevant? How's that one comment, it's not sex that's the problem, it's sin that's the problem, relevant to this story? Yes.
Because Bryn Mawr is kind of pining after
Arthgal,
but it's in a way, it's not aimed toward
lustful.
Right, lust, it's more toward pure love.
But it's going to be sexual love.
Yeah, she's going to have sex with him.
That's right.
It's going to be after they get married or something.
I got another one quickly from a I didn't have time to find an attribution for this one, but again, it's the rays of light coming out of the sun, turning into a dove, headed right for the lap. Again and again. So, what do you make of the fact that? Well, I won't ask that as a question. I'll just... Yes, Mike.
I was going to say, I think Selma had touched on this before, but it mentioned that they were born without original sin.
Yes.
The twins when they were born out, and then that's another, like, biblical illusion, with the golden beam of light, that kind of thing.
How blasphemous is this to make up a story that alludes to the virgin birth and give it to your character? And why isn't he getting in trouble?
I don't think he's tasteless about it.
He's not tasteless about it? Okay.
I mean, there are other biblical allusions within the story. I mean, the Garden of Adonis is, I think, very reminiscent of the Garden of Eden, which is, I think, a little bit contradictory, since one of them is taken there and it's sort of a place that's pleasure, even. I mean, as in the Garden of Eden, there's no rain. It's all, that was one thing that jumped out at me, is it's all water between the, like, creeks. And
yep.
There's also like the pit of there's a chaos, which is sort of, I thought, reminiscent of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And maybe because the entire book has biblical connotations.
That's entirely possible. How else does he get away with it? I mean, first of all, he's writing for an audience of fellow humanists, the people that are quite interested in seeing parallels and analogies between Christianity and the pagan Greek mythology. Anything more about that?
I mean, it probably wasn't like really wide read by like the masses who
certainly
would
not.
Probably have taken the most offense to
certainly
it.
Certainly not. Also, his very strategy of allegory provides a consistent, sustained cover for him. Because at all times he can say the classical myths are allegorical for the Christian myths rather than vice versa. And so it allows him to do what's really quite intellectually fascinating, to show how, you know, the Greek mythology had its version of the Immaculate Conception, much like the Virgin, much like that of, as it's depicted in Renaissance painting of the Virgin Birth, Virgin Conception, so that the allegory works that way to make everything signify on several levels. So it protects him even as it deepens this story. I'd like to go back to Venus and Adonis. So the Garden of Adonis. First of all, what's the Garden of Adonis about?
Isn't it kind of where like souls are kind of like nurtured before they're clad in flesh and sent back into the world?
That's right. It's a myth of pre-existence of the soul. Does anyone know what his source for that myth would be?
Buddhism a little bit?
Yeah, it has a lot of resemblance, but Spencer would not have known it.
From the aim?
The cycle of life, reincarnation, comes from...
The aim?
What?
The aim?
Plato.
Oh, yeah.
Plato. So the pre-existence of the soul, the existing for 1,000 years, then coming out through the Golden Gate into life, returning after your mortal years through the Iron Gate back to the Garden of Adonis to spend another 1,000 years in pleasure while waiting for reincarnation. It was all Spencer's invention, but stimulated by Plato. Matt, you started us off telling us about the twins, Belphoebe and Amoret. How were they discovered? Then you don't have to answer if that. Yeah, Max says.
By Venus and.
Pardon me?
By Venus and Diana.
Yeah, Venus and Diana stumble upon them. While searching for what?
Cupid.
So tell the story of why is Venus lost Cupid?
She's fine.
Yeah.
They get into a little fight. And he like goes on a.
He goes on a tantrum.
And wrecks all of the earth, really.
And if
I... to all the cities and stuff like that, asking about where he is. They're like, well, he was here, and now we hate him. He's not here now. And so she goes everywhere, and she goes, oh, maybe he's in the forest with the nymphs, because he falls in love with the nymphs a lot.
So if I had asked the question I was considering, name three places Cupid visits while... three places Venus searches for Cupid, what would you have said? Cities?
Cities.
The forest,
clearly. Pardon me? Country.
I said the plains.
Yeah, plains, countryside, which is different from the forest. And very in Spencer, the countryside is always different from the forest. The forest is wasteland. The forest is where beasts and transformations occur. The forest is a dangerous place. Forest is like in Tolkien. You go into the forest, unusual things happen. It's a magical space in Spencer. Countryside is arable land. It's cultivated. It's domesticated. Oh, so it's city, court, and countryside, and forest. And finally they find him in the forest. What's Diana doing in this story?
Venus comes up on her.
She's hunting.
She's resting
from the hunt. Yeah.
She kind of makes fun of Venus, doesn't she? When Venus says she's missing her son, then it's kind of like, well, good riddance.
Yep. Diana is...
Venus does something that makes Diana mad.
What's Diana's role as a goddess?
She's the goddess of the hunt.
Goddess of the hunt?
And
of the moon. What's the moon's name in Greek? Luna in Latin, in Greek. What are some mythic names for the moon? Cynthia.
Cynthia.
Definitely. Phoebe. So you got Phoebus, the sun, Phoebe, the moon. Consequently, her twin that she swiped is Belphoebe, named for herself. Venus, what's implied in Amoret?
Little love.
Amoret, that little love, right. What's Diana doing in this story? Characterize her some more. She's the goddess of what?
Oh, she sends all the nymphs out to her.
No, she's not the goddess of war exactly.
She's
hunting. You're on the right track.
She got in the dark side to the dark twin, I guess. This is the one of love and then the one of the moon.
She's the strong side of femininity.
She's the strong side of femininity. Remind you any of any character in book three? Yeah, Diana. Britomart, then.
Yeah.
Britomart, but she's... Diana is the huntress. What's her number one word, adjective used about her in mythological stories? Chase. But she doesn't like sex. She is not only... can't be true. Because of Actaeon.
Doesn't like it as much.
Except on
rare occasions with Actaeon. Exactly. Okay. Take that back. Strike that from the recording. Nonetheless, she is not an amorous god like her sister Venus. So you've got the huntress and the goddess of love looking for Cupid. Like Britomart looking for her lover. So that Diana's coming into the story is to fuse that character, that fierce warrior. And you did say, you know, when you said warrior, you weren't off. You know, the huntress, the arms-bearing female into the story. What's the Garden of Adonis remind you of in Tolkien?
Oh, where the elves go in the boat. I forgot what it's called.
Oh,
what I'm talking about.
I say Bombadil.
The Western Shore.
Bombadils?
I would say Bombadil.
The Garden of Adonis.
Yeah.
It's that place where elves go and they die.
Oh,
the Western Shore?
We don't see that, though. I don't know if that's true or not.
But the same thing. I was just blindly guessing.
You said Tom Bombadil?
Yeah.
His
little house.
It's very much like that. If you look at Canto 6, stanza 42, just give you a line there about the Garden of Adonis. There is continual spring and harvest there, continual, both meeting at one time. For both the boughs do laughing blossoms bear, and with fresh colors deck the wanton prime of spring, and eke at once the heavy trees they climb, which seem to labor under their fruit's load. The whiles the joyous birds make their pastime amongst the shady leaves their sweet abode, and their true loves without suspicion tell abroad. Yeah, it's very much a Bombadil kind of place of continuous spring and fruition. Bombadil himself is a person with a complete magic green touch. And so this passage, is one of those lyric interludes that you found dull in Tolkien, perhaps like Rivendell as well. until the council, but it's very much a part of the genre that Tolkien's interested in, the romance genre, that in between periods of strenuous adventure, you have these poetic passages of prolonged rest. The Cupid Tapestries in Canto 11 is the sixth Venus and Adonis motif, because Cupid is always part of the Venus and Adonis story. There you see Cupid in this Titian that we examined the other day. Here again in this Carracci, you see Adonis coming upon Venus with Cupid. Here we also discuss this Rubens, Venus and Adonis, with Cupid in the act. Now, here is the other element of the myth that we haven't discussed, and you notice Cupid is not present. You notice Cupid is present there on the left, well observed. I don't see any wings on the one to the right. There's a quiver of arrows on the left and there's wings. This is called the awakening of Adonis. But to my eyes, it looks like he's deathly. Does it seem deathly to you?
He does look like he's waking up.
The iconography of this painting by the Pre-Raphaelite painter John William Waterhouse is that of the Pietà. What is the Pietà? Yes, sir.
Mary holding Jesus in like a mourning pose.
In a mourning pose after Jesus has come down from the cross. So after the deposition from the cross, you have the Pietà with him, often either sprawled at her feet with her bending over him or lying across her lap. So that Spencer, I think, again, is allegorizing the Venus and Adonis story to the Mary and Jesus story, because Adonis dies. And here's another Pietà by Rubens. And it's crystal clear that Rubens intended a viewer of a painting like this. Rubens did many Pietas. He did several Venus and Adonises. It's clear that he intended you to make that same kind of allegorical connection across religious traditions between the Christian story and the classical one. So Cupid is quite hard at work in Canto 11 in the tapestry. We've already seen him get Jove inspired to go out as, you know, the bull for Europa, the gold for Danae, Leda the swan, a bunch of other ones that I'd never even heard of. Then he gets Apollo, then he gets Neptune, then he gets Saturn, a Titan. And then he gets Mars. How do you describe Cupid's character?
Mischievous.
Exactly. He's very mischievous. Very mischievous.
I think in the last canto, though, I mean, he gets almost downright evil.
Well, does he get evil?
Almost. But
what happens when Britomart defeats Boussorin?
Then he reverses the spells.
And what happens to the castle?
It disappears.
All of it. All the interior decoration disappears when Boussorin is defeated. And so is Spencer saying Cupid is evil then?
Based on his friends. I mean, all his friends are like fear and grief. And not nice people.
He always rides a lion. He does enjoy himself, but that's part of his mischievous. Here, Cupid is often depicted in painting and in literature riding a lion, which is, you know, how does a little putti, a little naked cherub with wings, which is the definition of a putti, by the way, how does a putti subdue a lion? Well, through his mischievous power to disseminate love and make even the mighty and the great turn into little lap dogs and pets. But in that final depiction of Cupid, in the mask of Cupid, with fear and sorrow and all of those despair, you read it as just Cupid becoming directly evil by then.
Well, I mean,
much darker, not mischievous, but dark and cruel.
Sinister,
cruel, dark. That's certainly a valid reading. Yes, sir, Max. Nope. Yes.
I think it sort of goes along with his mischievousness because he's very spontaneous. He's not thinking about what he's doing. He's just making people fall in love. And I think Spencer's saying is that love is sort of bigger than Cupid.
Uh-huh.
Cupid just kind of, he's like a drug. Like, he causes love to happen, but love isn't all flowers and happiness. It has all these little friends that Cupid.
You guys are persuading me. That wasn't my interpretation, but I think you all are beginning to persuade me. The way I'd read it was that was Bucerain's vision of Cupid. Because when it vanishes, you know, you're made aware that that tapestry was just a magic spell by Bucerain, so that it's Cupid as viewed through Bucerain's really sinister eyes. But I think I like your interpretations equally as well, maybe better than my own. So don't back away from that. What's the final image of Venus and Adonis, and we're almost finished discussing Spencer for the day. What?
Let's get him where it engages.
There's another wounding. There's a last wounding in Book 3. Who gets wounded in Canto 1 of Book 3? Bucerain is, I mean, it's really gruesome. Bucerain is, in the first night, the vision is that she sees Bucerain take Amoret's heart out. But the next day, she sees that was just an illusion. That second night, she sees but Bucerain is cutting her at the heart. But that's not the last person wounded in Book 3.
Britomart
gets wounded by Bucerain. So it perfectly rhymes with Britomart being wounded in Canto 1. It ends with Britomart being wounded in Canto 12.
Oh.
Rhymed or parallel. So Book 12, stanza 33. Check that out. It's not in the thigh, mind you. It aligns her with her sister, Amoret, because she's wounded right in the chest. From her to whom his fury first he meant, the wicked weapon rashly he did wrest, took the weapon out of Amoret's chest, and turning to herself his fell intent, unawares, it struck into her snowy chest, that almost exact same line, that little drops empurpled her fair breast. Exceeding wroth therewith the virgin grew, albeit the wound were nothing deep impressed, and fiercely forth her mortal blade she drew to give him the reward for such vile outrage due. So he should not have messed with her.
I see right there, her heart was mean. I'm not going to mean that. That's
Because it was just the stanza before. He had been wounded in the heart of Amareth, so now he... Yeah, I see. That's it. Easy mistake to make. Who will end the class by discussing in global terms why the book devoted to chastity has got such a sustained reading of the story of Venus, Adonis, and Cupid? Well, I just wanted to show you this great picture by Tintoretto that I saw in the Alta Pinakothek, in Munich this summer. It's an amazing painting. Vulcan, who's Vulcan?
The forge guy.
He's lame.
He's married to someone really
lame.
He's married to somebody really beautiful. Venus. That would be Venus.
Yeah.
So Venus has an adulterous affair with Mars. Can you see Mars peeking out underneath the where he's hidden underneath the bed? And Vulcan, there over on the right. Look at Cupid lying there, sound asleep. What kind of image? You know, he looks sated. He looks like he's been having sex, not Mars and Mars and Venus. Yeah, really, look at that. And so there you've got Vulcan, and the guidebook helpfully said that Vulcan was looking for Mars under the bedclothes covering Venus. Is that what your eyes see in that painting?
No.
But he is looking for evidence of adultery, I would say, right there. I show you this painting to give you more context for the...
Looking for Mars under the bedclothes. Maybe he's not looking for Mars, but looking for evidence.
And maybe the guidebook was not as prudish as I thought it was. This is a randy set of stories. Why is Book 3 devoted to imagery, tapestries, retellings of Venus, Adonis, and Mars?
Correct. Well, the way I took it was just because it's about chastity doesn't mean that there can be no sex or no love. Because the Bryn Mawr's form of chastity is based on... She does love someone, but she is just stolid about that. And it's not that she's just going to keep her virginity for her entire life.
Very well said. Should we end on that note? And turn over the class to Professor Hall, who has waited with great patience for his chance to introduce us to the next part of our course. Let me say that you should bring your Spencer to class every class period for the remaining of the semester.
You will need your
have
Spencer.
It on PDF.
Just however you've done it, in whatever form, I want you to have the text with you in every class period. So if that means bringing your laptop.
Okay, we have a short period of time, and I'm going to introduce sort of the next stage of the course, and I want to give us some context as to why we are doing what we're doing and the way we're doing it. You've enjoyed the literary stylings of Professor Clayton for the last three class sessions, and it's really fantastic. You can't hear?
I can't hear you very well.
Okay, I guess it's all the hum over there. We've explored a set of content, a story. You guys have a general understanding of that space in which was it the jet engine on the XBS over there?
It was the jet.
You have a general understanding of the space that we're going to create. What does Jesper Juul call this act of moving from one media to another?
Remediation.
Yeah. Ultimately, we're going to go right back to there, and we're going to remediate something. We're remediating Spencer into this Neverwinter Nights venue. I want to achieve a couple things before we part very quickly. I want to establish some context for why we're doing this. Who in here thinks writing and reading books is dead as a medium? Anybody believe that? Raise their hand. Dunbar, Jay will close his eyes. Professor Clayton will close his eyes if you want to do this. Who thinks? How would you prove that? What would be an indicator? That
book sales?
Sales, yeah.
Book sales, yeah. I think that's probably in our capitalist society that is there. What do you see there at the top? This is American Association of Publishers. This data is pretty consistent. I found this pretty quickly. But if you go from 2004 to 2005, $25.1 billion a year in book sales. That's not trivial. Right, 9.9% increase in those sales. I'm going to draw another attention. Look at the all-time box office. You know, Star Wars. These are 600 million. You know, the Titanic is the $600 million all-time box office. This is another form of the media that we've explored here. Star Wars, $460 million. Okay, keep going down. Look at all these top 25s are in the $300 million. Look what I wrote over to the side there. Halo 3, $300 million. That places in a very short period of time. That's all time. Halo 3, people have shelled out $300 million.
Well, yeah, but movies are $8 and Halo 60.
But I'm talking about revenue.
Some people will see a movie more than one.
Yeah, some people will play Halo a lot more in terms of hours invested. So we can slice these numbers up a lot of ways and talk about ticket sales and volumes of people doing it. That's a lot of cash in absolute terms, and that's equivalent. That's more than the 6 cents made in its all-time. So the important thing here, $300 million impact on one game title means that gaming is in the mainstream. People are willing to shell out cash to that order of magnitude in the same, right up there in the top 26, 27 spot. It would displace the 27th film on the IMDb all-time gross list. All right, now I want you to check this out with another part. Someone read that highlighted, sir. This is a bad box office from Advertising Age. Read that highlighted section right there under total industry ticket sales.
Total industry ticket sales were only $80 million for October. For the October 5th weekend, the film opened, a whopping 27% below the same weekend the year before. Many film executives are convinced audiences stayed home to play Microsoft's Carpal Tunnel classic Halo 3, which went on sale on September 26. The game sold an astonishing $170 million worth of copies on its first day before going on to sell well over $300 million.
I don't find that in any way trivial, Michael.
That list that we were just showing with all the movies, that's lifetime box office.
Yes, that's
right?
Correct.
The game you can buy for years after it's been released. So, I mean, in a year, I bet you Halo will be way higher than that.
I think it's going to move up the charts, to Michael's point.
Also, with Halo, a lot of it's online, so I think some of the Xbox Live subscriptions should be factored into total
revenue, right? And that's just title from Halo 3 sales, straight up. Chris?
Well, there's three kids on my floor that bought a 360 for the sole purpose of playing Halo 3. Yeah.
So the titles drove the console sales as well. So Microsoft's getting it there. You know, Xbox is a losing proposition right now for Microsoft financially.
Just like PlayStation.
Yeah. Same thing as PlayStation, exactly. Peter?
When you count those Xboxes, then we have to start talking about T-shirt sales with Shrek on them and like
Halo
the Burger King dollar cups.
No,
with Shrek
because you don't need those to go see the movie, whereas you need the Xbox to play the game.
If we were in economics class, we probably would, but since we're participating in the English department, we probably don't. Jeff, what was that?
People don't buy a TV just to watch one movie.
We don't have one.
Well, I think
plus anybody can go to the movies. Only people who own the Xbox can play the game.
Let me drive back to my point, guys.
It makes the market look small.
Books are not dead. Right? Books are not dead. Matter of fact, quite the opposite. The evidence economically indicates that this boat is floating a little higher in the ocean. Halo is now comparable to movie box office sales. It's all boats are rising in this space, Peter.
Book sales are increasing. But does that include per capita?
Yeah,
because I mean, there are a lot more people, and even though we're buying more books as a society, we could be reading them less.
I think that may be a research topic for you. I think what I want to get us to focus on, and these are good. You know, what is the X over Y denominator in actual economic value in comparable periods of time? People are spending their precious resources at the same rate and an ever increasing rate. This is the important message. Now, you can go back and you can divide X over Y per capita, per household, per family, per child, and we can play that game quite a bit, and it will detract from the core of the message. The core of the message is games are becoming mainstream. It's economically indicated by the economic impact. It's certainly indicated by Microsoft and Sony's willingness to invest a loss-leading console, Xbox and PS3, to produce titles. Titles are the form of narrative play. People are spending time in different ways. And this is what I'm going to draw your attention over to the left side here, the mouse or the remote. Matt, would you kind of read just the top couple sentences of that article? It's in the PC Magazine, October 2007.
Which do you spend more time glued to, the web or the tube? If your answer is the web, you're not alone. A study from IBM Research shows that web surfing has surpassed TV watching in the U.S., with 26% of survey respondents spending more than 6 hours per day online. Mm-hmm. This is, perhaps, not so alarming when you consider that many use the internet during a work day, though only personal time was counted for the survey.
Oh boy.
All five countries surveyed had a higher percentage of people online for 4 hours or more than the people watching TV for the same duration.
It's pretty interesting how people expend their time. There's a lot of studies on this. Go look them up on the internet if you're curious. I recommend an authoritative one, the Pew Internet Survey. That the Pew is what P-E-W is what you need to look at. That's more authoritative than Bubba's blog on this topic. So please use Pew. Where's you've got it here, Jay? Can you put the? Let me just jump it right here, real quick.
Okay.
And source writing. So why is it? It's a little bit dark there, but I'll get to that in a second. Why are these statistics important, guys? That I just what would be my intention in putting these out here? Any ideas?
Games are coming on to the same level as books and movies are.
That's one message I think is important. Games are now a valid medium of narrative expression.
That's right.
Is that, Professor, would you like to say it any differently? Games are a valid medium of narrative expression, would be to Chris's point.
Are you suggesting that Halo has a legitimate narrative?
I think it does. I played it. Me and my boys play it.
Really?
Yeah. I think Half-Life does. Do you think anybody played Half-Life?
They've written books on Halo.
I think so.
My brother read the books of Halo after he played the game because he liked the narrative.
And that's a remediation from a game to a book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I mean, we can debate it, but this is my... I'm just going to put my supposition out here. I think when I play Halo and I'm Master Chief and running around, even when you first parachute in and you're waking up, there's a context and a story behind it. I mean,
Knights of the Old Republic had an amazing storyline, if anyone put that, the first one. It was way better than any of the new Star Wars movies have been.
So another item I want to get to real quickly, because I'm rapidly running out of time. Chris, watch my time for me real quick, would you?
Yeah.
Another point is the way people are spending their time. They're interfacing more and more in these digital worlds. So when we look at books, part of that book revenue is audiobooks, distributed through Audible.com and places like that. You're also seeing e-books. You're seeing books not in a traditional paper print form, but also considered books distributed through digital vehicles, right? So there's a whole new form of digital distribution. So at the end of the day, I want the message to be this. It's a valid form of narrative expression in the games. You can take, and you'll see, any major movie comes out is going to have probably some form of book, some form of game, and the movie, and the soundtrack, right? There's going to be all these aspects. So now, people must have much more time to spend here in these spaces. So I think having the skills to tell a story in this particular medium would be very important. That's where we're taking you now. You've had an opportunity to actually be educated as to good consumers. You've been introduced to an amazing topic with great facility and great understanding, and Spencer. Now we're going to take that property, and we're going to translate it into this space right here. What I have done as an example of this, which is a wee bit difficult to see on the screen, but this is our conference room here. This is Neverwinter Nights 2 up on the board, nwn2.vanderbilt.edu. You can go in and explore this. But this is Velikatonis has joined left.
I can't load the module.
Okay, I need to check out what's going on, why we're having trouble there.
What was it again?
nwn2.vanderbilt.edu. Peter, if you have time, stick around with me after class briefly so I can test something. But all I did was I remediated the conference room. I didn't have time to build, as Matt said earlier, where's all the people? Well, I built the important one, which was me, into the environment, but I want you to see that. Now, there's many, many important things we're going to talk about, but you can see things like this is, let me turn it
running around.
This is our smart board. It's hidden there. That's our smart board device here. There's a freshman who was incapacitated as a result of their journey through Spencer.
I thought you killed him because he was downloading songs.
I am not the song police.
This guy's handsome as well.
And then here's this handsome fella here. If I can get him talking to us.
Barely
there.
Hello, knowledge seeker.
Hello, your majesty is the only option.
So each one of these objects can be given names.
M. Diddy?
They could be given M. Diddy. That's me, Matt. M. Diddy. So each one of these objects, what I'm going to show you is, and for example, this is our LCD display. Your objects can be given names in the environment. Why would naming things in the environment be relevant to the Spencer journey if we're going to do Castle Joyous? Would you want to put a name to a tapestry? A piece of furniture, an environmental object, would that carry your story forward? How relevant is scene and place object naming, person naming, the dialogue tree which the objects are going to contain, how relevant are they? I'm out of time, so I'm going to leave you with that. We're going to take this story, we're going to remediate it, and everyone invites to. Thank you for your time and attention.